right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we have a really special show for you today. At the back end of the show, we're going to be listening to an interview I recently did with Neil deGrasse Tyson. Yep, that's right, Neil deGrasse Tyson, astrophysicist, author, and director of the American Museum of Natural History's Hayden Planetarium. And I was talking with Neil about his latest book, Astrophysics for People in a Hurry. You don't want to miss this interview. It was quite a trip. And before that, we'll be listening to some comments from Bob Avakian about the situation facing black people and all people in this country today. All right, so you don't want to miss that. There's some very important thoughts in there, some very important things for people to be thinking about and taking out to people everywhere. All right, that's how important it is. And opening the show up, I'm really pleased to be welcoming back to the show Carl Dix. Carl is a member of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and for the last month or so, he's been involved with a very special project in Chicago. And he's been doing a lot of work among the people in Chicago because the people in Chicago are facing a hellified situation. And Carl's here to talk with us about black people killing each other while the fascist Trump prepares to bring down the hammer on them. All right, we're talking genocide of black people, and we're talking the horrors facing everyone who doesn't stand up and demand an end to this. So without any further ado, let's jump into it. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on again, Michael.
Sure. Let's jump into it because I don't want to cut any corners with you on this. You've been in Chicago for a while, and including the Revolutionary Communist Party, the Revolution Club, have focused a lot of attention on the situation in Chicago, which is bad. And in fact, you issued a statement focused up around this and what you called insanity. What is it that's going on in Chicago these days?
Look, here's what's going on in Chicago. Our young people are caught up in killing each other. It is concentrated on the south side of Chicago, and on the west side, it is mostly young black people. And look, it is just heartbreaking to wake up every morning to reports, and almost every morning to a report that another young black person or maybe a few young black people were killed by other young black people, and maybe some older black people or even some little children were caught up in the crossfire. You want to know how heartbreaking it is? Summer is coming up, and people are looking forward to summer with great fear. Now, summer should be a time when kids are like, looking forward to going swimming, riding their bikes, being able to play ball till late in the night, where young people are thinking about taking a first chance at romance, and where parents are planning family trips to visit relatives or go to museums. But parents are talking about, we got to keep our kids in the house, because if we don't, they might get killed in this surge of violence. And this has got to stop. And the revolution is throwing in to stop it. It's got to stop because it's heartbreaking. People shouldn't live like this. And it's even more urgent to stop it because the fascist Trump Pence regime has a plan to use this violence to make Chicago ground zero in an overall assault against black people with the aim of wiping out the struggle of black people once and for all, making that slow genocide that I've talked about that America brings down on black people into a fast genocide. So we can't let that happen. And look, it's the system that's got our kids caught up in this, you know, because our kids did not take the legitimate ways to survive and raise families out of their communities. They didn't gear the educational system to fail them. The system did that. It's got them caught up in this, where the only way to be somebody, the way to carve out some survival, is to get into some hustle or other that often has you fighting against another group of young people to control a few city blocks of turf that neither of you own, and viewing each other as your enemies when you're each held down by the same system. We got to get our youth out of this and get them into the revolution, because that's what's going to be needed to end it once and for all, and all the other horrors the system brings down.
So tell me this, Carl, what are you telling people, especially with these, you know, you're talking about these youth, and we know it from, you know, I remember when I first came out here to L.A., it was a very, you know, very similar, not the same, and it's times have developed since then, things can get sharper, but there was this thing where you, wherever you walk in a lot, and especially in neighborhoods of the oppressed people, where you walk, there's always this, there's some kind of tension like this going on, where people are all wrapped up in this kind of warfare, where what they see is the most important thing, is the territory that they live in. They protect this, they do that, they're up against each other for the slightest, you know, perceived or real, you know, whatever thing happens to them, then it becomes internecine warfare. It can get really, really brutal and horrible. What are you telling people? You know, how are you taking this on?
Well, look, we have been going at this for quite some time, and we've really taken it to another level in the past few months. In fact, we have put out a statement from the Central Committee of the Revolutionary Communist Party, titled What the Trump-Pence Regime Means to Black People and What Must Be Done About It Now, which details this plan that they have to use Chicago and the violence here to make Chicago ground zero for this overall assault on black people. And we go to people and we say, things don't have to be this way. We get why you're caught up in this. You're going up in these torn up communities where your only chance to be somebody is maybe to join the military and get sent off around the world to kill some other oppressed people to keep America on top, or to get into the street life and its code of revenge. But then we say to them, you are acting on conditions the system has enforced on you, and you're acting on them with the system's way of thinking. Look out for number one. Go for you and your small group and prey on and stab everybody else in the back to get yours. And then you're also doing what the system wants you to do, fighting and killing each other, which makes it easier for them to control all of us. And that you can get out of this. The revolution is here to lead you in getting out of it, and to get into something that's really worth living and dying for. Because living and dying over a few blocks of city streets that you call your turf, that you don't even really own, and killing other people just like you over it, for something that ain't worth two dead flies, as they used to say back in the Black Panther Party in its heyday. But there is something to live and die for, and that something is revolution. And we're going to be holding a rally this weekend, tomorrow, in South Shore, which is on the south side of Chicago, one of the largest black communities in the country, actually, not just in Chicago, in the country, taking this message and this challenge to the young people to get out of the insanity of killing each other and get into the revolution, a revolution that's about getting everybody free. And how we can work with them to deal with understanding what revolution is all about, why it's possible, why we can win, the leadership we have for it in Bob Avakian, the leader of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and then how we're going to deal with the actual concerns that people raise up to us about, if I'm not out here doing this, how do I survive? What do I do about people wanting to get revenge? The party's here to work with people to deal with all of that as part of people getting into and being part of a revolution that can emancipate all of humanity.
I want to remind listeners that we're talking today with Carl Dix, a member of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and we're talking with him about Chicago, black people killing each other while the fascist Trump prepares to bring down the hammer. Now, Carl, what's the response you've been getting when you've been taking that out to people? I mean, imagine it's got to be both kind of jarring to people, and then there's, I imagine there's also some argument back and forth, because this is a whole way that people have been trained to look at themselves in life and how to survive, and, you know, that you got to get some any way you can in a certain sense, and or protect what you have. And now you're coming up with this really broad vision that's very very emancipating, liberating, and is aiming for a whole new society where this kind of stuff is abolished, and that these people right now actually have a, you know, you're calling on them to step up in a way that probably very few people ever have called on them to step up in this way. And I'd like to know what's the response been?
Okay, the word that you used, jarring, actually gets at it, and we are intentionally going to jar people because people have fallen into a way of thinking that actually perpetuates and keeps the system and the conditions that have them doing this stuff in effect, and they got to be jarred out of it. And we get wildly different responses. Some people are attracted to this and inspired by it, but then have questions about, is it real? Can it work? Can you really beat them? Aren't they too powerful? And we get into, yeah, they're powerful, but they got vulnerabilities. They got weaknesses. And Bob Avakian has gone to work on identifying what those weaknesses are and developing a strategy for how the revolution could go to work on them to get ready and in position to lead millions and going for revolution all out when the time comes for that. It's not time for that yet, but we got to get ready now because it could come all at once and seemingly from nowhere. We get responses like, I ain't going to follow no white man. And then we say to them, look, you've been ruled over by a white supremacist system all your life, a system that sets the limits on what you can do and can't do. That's what you've been dealing with all your life. Then the revolution comes with a way to get out from under that. And your question is, I ain't going to get with this because this guy is white. That ain't the question about leadership. The question about leadership is it getting to the root of the problem? And does it have a way to deal with that problem? That's the actual question about leadership. And get off of this silliness. If you were sick with a disease that was ravaging humanity and a doctor came forward and said, I've got the cure to that disease, would your question be, is this doctor black or white? Is this doctor male or female? Is this doctor straight or gay? Or would your question be, is this cure for real? Well, Bob Avakian's got the cure for the disease of imperialism, and you got to get into it. And on the basis of getting into it, you got to get into this revolution and be a part of wiping out that disease. And this, we get these and other questions, as well as we get the questions from people of, I want to get with this, but how do I survive if I'm not out here doing what I got to do, you know, to make some money? What do I do about people who want to get revenge from me? Because some people want to get out of it and actually never saw anything as inspiring and as attractive as getting into the revolution. But then they got these practical concerns. So we have to deal both with the practical concerns, but mainly we got to deal with this way of thinking, the way of looking at things, that what we're dealing with now is just the way it has to be. So we have to adjust to it. We got to jar people out of that, and that's what we're working to do, and that's what this message that I'm going to deliver from the revolution tomorrow is going to be getting at. And people really need to go to the website revcom.us. They need to go to that website because it's got material about the situation in Chicago. It's got what we're doing about it, including the message that we're going to deliver. And we're going to video this rally, and the video of the rally is going to be available soon after it's done. I can't give you a deadline, date, and time, but we're going to get it up soon after it's done because we want everybody to be able to check this out. We want everybody to hear what we're saying, and we want everybody to respond to the challenge of doing what they need to do to help make it possible for these young people to get out of the trap that the system's got them caught in, fighting and killing each other, and to get into the revolution. Because this is important for the potential to actually make revolution in this country and end all these horrors, and to the very important need to unite with everybody possible to drive this Trump-Pence regime out. Because a lot of people have been looking at Trump and what he's been doing and saying, oh, he's stumbling and fumbling and he's not really accomplishing anything, while they are steaming ahead with enforcing a fascist agenda and consolidating fascist rule. And you just look at what the Department of Justice has done over the past couple of months with taking a big change in the way that sentencing goes down to revive and reinvigorate the war on drugs, which is really a war on black and brown people that set more people up to be sent off to prison and warehoused in jails. They have reopened up the thing of the federal government using private prisons to keep the people that they're going to throw in jail in for longer periods of time. And they're backing away from investigating any of the horrors that the police departments around the country have been perpetrating. And look, these investigations that the Obama administration did, they were window dressing. But what Sessions and Trump are saying is, we ain't going to do no more window dressing. We're going to bring the hammer down in ways that people can't even imagine. So we've got to step up dealing with this. And that's what we're going to be doing with this rally and starting something that will make this a summer in Chicago of youth getting out of killing each other and into the revolution, and not a summer of more violence among the people.
All right, Carl. Extremely important. We're going to have you back to talk about this. And people, if you're listening, you can get a link right to the page that Carl's talking about, Chicago Scenes from Revolutionary Organizing, on my Facebook page. And
yeah, that's it.
All right, that's great. And we will. And people can get that right on my Facebook page. So go there and you can get right there. Carl, I want to thank you very much for bringing this to people, continuing to bring this to people. And I really want to talk to you again when it comes up. And we will actually even try to get some sound from that rally and put it on the air. Because people need to hear this. We need to stop this. This is, you know, the genocide is real and it's got to be stopped. So, Carl, thank you very much for joining us, man.
Thank you for having me on again, Michael.
Sure. Talk to you soon, man. Bye. All right, sisters and brothers, I'm going to try and control how I'm feeling right now, because it's a very heavy thing to hear about young people killing themselves, killing each other, young black people killing each other. While the system bears down further, harder and harder on them, while it bears down harder and harder on them and makes their lives worthless, that makes them just fodder for the police and for the system. If they can't throw you into jail for the rest of your life, then they just take your life away from you. That's what they're doing. I want to remind listeners that we've been talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party, who's in Chicago on a very special mission. Carl is in Chicago talking to people about black people killing each other while the fascist Trump prepares to bring down the hammer, and being out there among the people themselves, really trying to struggle this out and get people going in the direction that's really going to mean something in terms of stopping this oppression. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. Welcome back. That was Voice of Revolution by Savage Rose. Right now, I want to take a few minutes to actually bring to you and listen to with you a comment, an observation by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. Now, some of you have known about this, have heard this before, but I think it's really, really appropriate to play this now. After what we've just listened to, what Carl was telling us about what's going on in Chicago, the kind of horrifying lives that people are being forced to live, and the struggle that people are waging with black people, black youth in particular, to get up out of this and start standing up against the system. And this is a piece by Bob Avakian, and the name of this piece is A Better World is Possible. Taken from his speech, Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About, which you can find on YouTube. And there's also a DVD of the speech that you can find at revcom.us, at the Bob Avakian page on revcom.us.
So for capitalism and every system based on exploitation and oppression, the only kinds of ideas it can produce and the kinds of ideas it promotes as the ruling ideas are, not surprisingly, ideas that justify all this exploitation and oppression, that teach people that this is the natural order of things, and that encourage people to try to become big dogs in this dog-eat-dog world. If this kind of world, this kind of system, if this were all that is possible, that'd be one thing. And you see people, even those who are brutally oppressed under this system, as long as they believe this is the only kind of world that's possible, you see them going along with this all the time. I got to get mine. I got to get what I can get within this. It's time to get yours. This reminds me of the story of the prisons in California, and in particular what was called the Corcoran Shoe, where the guards there would take prisoners and they'd tell them stories about each other, get them angry at each other, and they'd literally put them in pens like in the old Roman Colosseum, and they'd let them out of the pens and they'd come in and start fighting with each other, sometimes to the death. And the guards would be standing above watching all this, laughing and betting on the outcome, and if it got out of hand, they'd shoot one or more of the prisoners. This was a whole scandal that finally broke into the open in the California prisons. Well, if you just look from inside that, here you are, and the door opens, and you run out in this arena, and you start throwing hands and everything else you can with the other person who's there, you might say, I'm a bad mother. I'm handling this situation. But if you back the camera up a little bit, and look at the larger picture, what's happening? You're being handled. You're being put in this horrible situation by these people standing above you, laughing, betting, and ready to kill you if they see it in their interests. And that's a miniature picture, a microcosm, as they say, of what the world is like today and the way that people get caught up in going along with this. You hear these people say, you know, I'm on this corner selling my product. I'm regulating the corner. You ain't regulating shit. You're just being regulated. You're just being put there and allowed to be there as long as what you're doing serves the people who really regulate things, who really run this system, for as long as it serves them or doesn't get in their way. You hear people say, sometimes they get caught up in all this stuff about the hood. This is our hood. Can't nobody come in here and take over our hood. This is not your hood. You don't own this. You don't run it. You don't control it. The people who own it and run it and control it are just using you. They're just letting you be played like this and carry on with all this foolishness and dangerous stuff, killing each other off because it serves their interests. While they're keeping you in these miserable conditions, not really different than the prisoners in the Corcoran Shoe. It makes me think of a situation where you walk into a scene where there's a man got a gun in one hand and a big club in the other, and he's got everybody lined up. And he goes down the line breaking everybody's legs. And somebody jumps up and says, all right then, I'm going to be the baddest broke leg mother there is. Something's wrong here. What we need to be doing is say, hey, that man's breaking everybody's leg. Let's get together and stop that mother from breaking everybody's leg. Now, I understand how people try to make the best of their circumstances. They say, you didn't give me nothing else, you didn't leave me nothing else, so I'm going to take this, and at least this way I can get some respect before I go out. So we can understand this. But again, let's step back and look at the larger picture, the larger world. Because we, the masses of people, are capable of much greater things than this. We are capable of completely and radically changing our circumstances, changing all of society to get rid of circumstances like these. What happens in the world affects us, and we can affect the world. And when all is said and done, we can change the whole world together with people like us all over the world.
All right, once again, that was Bob Avakian, chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, talking about another world is possible. And you can find the speech and excerpts from it on YouTube. It's Revolution Talk. If you just search for that, you'll find that on YouTube. You can also find the entire speech, including a film of it, and excerpts from it at the Bob Avakian tab at revcom.us. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. Welcome back. That was John Fogerty with River is Waiting. Really beautiful song. I recently had the opportunity to read a book that just blew my mind. It's called Astrophysics for People in a Hurry. And actually, it's the kind of book that's not going to put you in a hurry, because I'll tell you what, you're going to sit down and you're just going to be knocked back with some of the things that are put out here, things that maybe you've never heard before, things that you want to hear, whatever, if you've heard them, a new take on them. The book is Astrophysics for People in a Hurry, and the author is Neil deGrasse Tyson, and I'm really pleased that Neil is joining us on the show today. Neil deGrasse Tyson, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Neil deGrasse Tyson, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, I have to tell you, reading your book, Astrophysics for People in a Hurry, just blew my mind. It's a really great book, and I want to dig into a lot of the points that are made in here. And things
well, I'm
that
glad it blew your mind, because that was the whole point.
I knew that. You know, I had that was message was coming through, man.
Plus, I also know that the book is short enough that a talk show host will likely be telling the truth when they said, oh, I read your book.
but I read every book,
no matter if it's
700 pages or,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, you're authentic.
Right, although I have to say, when I looked at the 200 pages and I said, but they're small pages.
Yeah, they're very small pages, yeah. Well, because you're in a hurry. That's
right.
The whole idea.
That's it, I got it.
I got fat books for you if you're not in a hurry. I got that.
Okay,
all right.
We're going to get along well. All right, well, let me ask you this. As we're talking about this, why this book? What compelled you to put this book out in the world now?
Well, I saw people who had noticed, I don't say read them, but noticed headlines that have come across in front of them. Again, busy people, people who work more than 40 hours a week, or students, or have kids. And so you lead an overscheduled life, but you're still curious. But how do you manifest this curiosity? And so meanwhile, here comes these headlines: exoplanets discovered, multiverse, simulation universe, dark matter, cosmic perspective. These are sort of dangling concepts that we've all heard in the news cycles, and maybe you've heard other people chatting about it, but they didn't have an organizational arc for them to live sort of coherently in your heart and in your mind. And so this book is a servant of that curiosity, and it's a curated offering of things that I find particularly interesting in the universe, and in my judgment, you would even find to be mind-blowing. And then you, the next morning at the water cooler, it's like you got something to talk about, or you'll be fluent with other people who spent more time reading the articles than you did. So it's a way to achieve astrophysical fluency.
You know, the other thing, though, that I was really moved by is, particularly in the world today, the whole idea of people needing to engage with science on to one degree or another, to the greatest degree that they can. And I think everybody can, but a lot of people don't. What I found about this book is it's very, very helpful in terms of the way it actually proceeded through the science, through astrophysics. You know,
you make a perceptive point about modern society. I don't think there's any truly important issue that we have to be informed about that isn't completely, certainly partially touched by science literacy that would be required of you, a voter, someone who has strong views. And in fact, there are people who have opinions that would be way more informed if they had a stronger sense of science literacy beneath them, beneath those opinions, right? I love when people argue opinions, but when people start arguing things that are not subject to their opinion, such as objective truths established by the methods and tools of science, then there is no democracy. You just, you know, you can't say, oh, I gained 3 pounds this week, I want to repeal the law of gravity. It doesn't work that way. And so we need to understand what these distinctions are. And I don't even blame adults. I think somewhere in the kindergarten through 12 curriculum, we're missing coursework we're missing items in the syllabus that will train you how to analyze information, how to turn facts, data into facts, facts into knowledge, knowledge into wisdom and insight. And this requires analysis. It requires skepticism. And by the way, in tandem with this, the entire internet landed in our laps. Given the history of civilization, it essentially landed in our laps overnight. But yet we're not trained how to sift through it in any kind of intelligent way. You have people believing everything or believing nothing, each of which is equally as intellectually lazy. Yes, it's hard to figure out what's true and what is not, but that should be a developed skill that we all have. And once you have that, oh my gosh, the power of citizenry that that comes with knows no bounds.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things I was thinking about as you're talking, there's a particular way that science does intersect with people's lives here, and it's not always that good, because when you think about it, when you go to school, you know, it's like people aren't sort of like infused with the, yo, I'm going to understand how the world operates and all this other stuff that's going on. And it's sort of like, for a handful of people, it might be that, but then for others, and hopefully that handful is growing beyond that now, but for others, there's this point about, yeah, I'm taking chemistry, I'm taking biology, I'm taking this. And I thought that part of it has to do with the way that you're talking about science is actually approached in the world. But also, you have a particular way that you bring science to people, which I think is really important. There's pop culture, but it's also that reality that really smacks people in the head and wakes them up, where you don't need a pop cultural connection. So it's those two things, those two different aspects I thought were really unique and important in what you're doing in this book.
Well, so thanks for calling that out. But I would say that the problem you cited is even bigger than how you constructed it. So, yes, many people think of their science class as a chore, and you can't wait to get through it. And the last day of class, you would delight in tossing your notes into the air as you ran down the steps of high school, saying, no more science, great. So ask yourself, why is that so? It's all too easy to blame the student, when, in fact, we all know who the greatest teachers are in our lives. And unfortunately, that's never more than just one or two, at most four. Rarely does a person have five singularly influential and great teachers in their lives. This is after having dozens, scores, and in some cases hundreds of teachers. We've never met. How many singularly influential teachers have you had in your life? Just give me a number. I bet it's three.
It's around a three or four.
It's around three or four. It's not 10. Why isn't it 10? Why isn't it 20? Why isn't it all of them? And so anytime I address students in ed schools, I say, be that teacher. Be the teacher where no matter what it is they were trying to get you to learn, you absorbed their enthusiasm for it. And it's one of the classes where if you didn't get an A, maybe you got a B or even a C, you could still at the end come out and say, that was one of the best classes I ever took. And so if that's the case, then you would regret the end of class. You'd say, I want to stay more. I don't want my summer vacation to come because I'm steeped in learning and I'm loving every minute of it. So that is one of the problems with the educational system. I don't have an easy fix for it until we get a cloning machine for these few teachers that make that kind of a big difference in our lives. But you're right. It operates not only on the level of sciences, but the general act of learning. Look at how we've branded, badly branded, the word homework and the word lecture. Even when you're not in school, you go to the office and you come in, you know, the boss gave me some homework I got to do to get the job done tomorrow. Or someone is speaking to you or they're trying to teach you something. Don't lecture to me, right? These are bad words in the rest of your life outside of school. Well, why? Why should they be? So the future of education ought to include ways to preserve your curiosity so that on the second day, the day after your last day of classes, be it over the summer, after high school, after college, the day after you say, I have just begun a life of learning because my curiosity will take me there.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Neil deGrasse Tyson, an astrophysicist with the American Museum of Natural History, director of its world-famous Hayden Planetarium, and the host of the hit radio and TV show Star Talk. He's also an award-winning author, and he lives in New York City. You know, one of the things that, as you were talking, one of the things I was thinking about as well is that there's a whole way that you approach this. The things that you put out is science. And then there are things like your star talk shows that actually, you know, when you're looking at that, hit at the dumbing down of the population and the dismissal of science. And I thought that was really sort of a, that two parts of you where you're actually really out there fighting like a pit bull for people to learn science as science. And then you also can take that twist in there where you hit at the dumbing down and you and the dismissal of science, and you counter this with something I thought was brilliant, make America smart again.
Yeah, you can't make America great again until you make America smart again. I think that's just how that plays. So a couple of things. First, so thanks for noticing that these various portals of access that I'm providing people, depending on what is your temperament, your patience, your curiosity level. And StarTalk is an interesting offering in this portfolio because it's inverted the traditional talk show concept. So it's a talk show about science, so how would you normally do that? You'd have a journalist or some entertainer, and their guests would weekly be scientists. Well, who tunes into that? You know, those are people who already know they like science because you're tuning in for the science. But how about the people who don't know they like science? Or better yet, the people who feel pretty sure that they don't like science. How do you bring science to them? And with StarTalk, since my guests are hardly ever scientists, they're people, my main guests, they're people hewn from pop culture, A-list people who you've heard of. You know, this Whoopi Goldberg, William Shatner, President Clinton. You've heard of these people. Even if you're not a follower of them, and even if you're not a fan of theirs, you know who they are. So they are part of a pop culture scaffold that we all bring to the table. And in my conversations with them, I talk about all the ways science has touched their lives. So presumably they have a fan base that will follow them wherever they go. And in this first occasion for that fan base, they follow their favorite actor, comedian, journalist, politician, they follow them to a conversation about science. And in this way, science spills into the rest of the population that wouldn't otherwise be making time to sit and listen to a science talk show.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that hit me too is that, and this is sort of, I'm going to move from one to the other real quick here, but, you know, you work very hard to stretch people's minds, and I was really appreciative of that, and opening doors and possibilities and thinking. And I thought particularly when you're talking about all this very serious stuff, and then all of a sudden you talk about the possibility of Earthlings being descended of Martians, and I have to say I was intrigued by your term panspermia, which kind of, you know, which, and when I sat back, I sort of chuckled, and then I thought, wait a minute, this is actually very serious, you know, and it's actually a way of stretching people's minds again to being open to how the universe might work.
Yeah, so this book is carefully written and conceived so that, and I'll tell you all my secrets. You ready?
Good. I'm writing them down.
These are my literary secrets. So there are some topics in the universe that are just fundamentally interesting, like black holes and, yes, panspermia. So when I discuss those in the book, I don't feel the need to reference pop culture to add nuances to the content, because the content could just live just sitting there all by itself. There's a whole chapter, for example, on the periodic table of the elements. This is something you're pretty sure you left behind in high school chemistry class. But what I do is celebrate it. But the best way to celebrate it is not to rehash what you promptly wanted to forget after chemistry class ended, but it's to offer all the ways that the elements on this table matter in our lives and in the universe itself. So there's more of a pop culture element to it. So with the discussion of panspermia, that is fun, and it's a really cool word, and the word's been around only for a couple of decades. So that carries you all by itself. It's like, whoa, we could be descendants of Martians. Mars microbes could have moved through space and landed on Earth. This is just mind-blowing, and it requires no help. I don't need to bring in the celebrity, the celebrity reference in order for you to capture that. So the book is a mixture of all these different tools I have to keep you going from page to page, to have you get through that book so that you want to finish it and you want that astrophysical fluency.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that you also talk about in relation to all this is you talk about, one, that the universe is under no obligation to make sense to anyone. But at the same time, and I thought this was really intriguing, you also talk about, and you presented a very powerful picture of the universality of physical laws that people do have to actually recognize and dig into.
Yeah. So what I mean by make sense is there, when the microscope and telescope were invented, both within about a decade of one another, by the way, around the year 1600, both invented in the Netherlands, by the way, as I understand that tracking of history. So once those two tools became part of the scientist's arsenal, you started gaining access to aspects of nature that fall completely outside of our five senses. So when Antoine von Leeuwenhoek perfected the microscope and put a drop of pond water underneath that microscope, first, the thought to even do that, just think about this. Why would you even do this? He does it, and he finds countless microorganisms doing the backstroke, right? And he called them animalcules, the cutest name ever. I think we should still call them that, the little animalcules. And he described this to the Royal Society in London in a letter, and they thought he was drinking too much. And they thought the letter was kind of a fun hoax, right? And it's not something they would chastise him for because they thought it was just a fun hoax. It had to be a hoax. You're saying there are animals swimming in a drop of water. What is wrong with you? Okay, they said, go sleep off this gin hangover and write another letter in the morning. So, of course, the good thing about science is no one result is what's true. You must verify it with either competitors or people who are disinterested or have different biases, because scientists are human too, and we have susceptibilities. But we have built-in error-checking mechanisms in the field, in the enterprise. So what the Royal Society did was send someone to the Netherlands to look through his microscope with him. And sure enough, they saw exactly the same thing, because, in fact, it was an emergent objective truth. These microorganisms defy common sense. Well, they certainly did in the day. Now we're accustomed to them. But just because you can't make sense of it doesn't mean it's not true. And so that's a recurring theme throughout the book. And on top of that, one of my favorite chapters, and thanks for finding it, it's titled On Earth as in the Heavens. And it's a celebration of how it is that experiments you do on Earth with chemistry and physics are revealing laws of nature from your laboratory. You discover that they are the same laws of nature manifesting not only across the universe, but across time itself. So they are, in fact, universal laws, which one of my pet peeves is people say, oh, meet Miss Universe. No, she's Miss Earth, okay? You didn't compare her to Martians. She's Miss Earth. And people use the word universal, I think, way too freely here on Earth. It's a little bit of human hubris when we do so. But that's not getting past me, the astrophysicist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. But it also brings me to this one, Einstein. You've said for the most mind-warping ideas of 20th century physics, just blame Einstein. And I wanted to talk to you about that because I thought the work that you did on presenting Einstein throughout this book is really important. And also, this way that it actually humanizes the whole process and the whole process of digging into this.
What I've done is, because there, you know, you have literary types out there and there's science-curious types, and you might even get some historians. There's at least a half dozen, maybe more, yeah, maybe as many as 10, and it's not a long book, so 10 is actually quite a few, stories about the history of the discovery that is the theme of the chapter. And you learn a little bit about who was involved and what was going on and what methods and tools they had to invoke. And again, this is a curated set of stories so that you will see and learn what struggles these scientists have been through to make the discoveries that they did. And so there's some people who greatly value these historical vignettes, and I'm delighted to be able to provide them for the reader.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Neil deGrasse Tyson, an astrophysicist with the American Museum of Natural History, director of its world-famous Hayden Planetarium, and the host of the hit radio and TV show Star Talk. He's also an award-winning author, and he lives in New York City. Now, you also talk about, though, in something like that, where you also talk about something I thought was actually very important in terms of the scientific method overall and people learning it and understanding what it is and what it means and how it functions when you talk about Einstein and lambda.
Oh, Yeah, so he had an equation of the universe. That's a cool equation no matter what, if it's of the universe. He had an equation that describes the large-scale structure of the universe. And in that equation was a term that had mathematically legitimate presence in the equation. But if it corresponded to something real in the real universe, it would have to be some kind of anti-gravity term. There is no anti-gravity. There's only gravity. And just because the math has a term in it, that where the rest of the equation is describing the known universe, doesn't mean everything in the equation has a correspondence to reality. So he simply discarded it and dusted it under the rug. Excuse me, I missed a step. So here's what happens. This term is there, and he describes the universe, and he says, wait a minute, the universe is unstable. I need to keep this term in the equation to prop up the universe against the collapsing force of gravity. Okay? That gave him a static universe. Well, no one had any freaking idea that the universe would be doing anything other than just existing. Why would the universe be expanding or contracting? That was so far-fetched, not even Einstein could imagine that. So he left the term in. Then, a few years later, Hubble, the man, not the telescope, discovers we live in an expanding universe. So he doesn't need the equation because, in fact, the universe is unstable in what it's doing. And he said introducing that lambda term was the biggest blunder of his life, this anti-gravity term. Well, fast forward 70 years, 80 years, and measurements suggest that, in fact, lambda is a real thing in the universe and that it represents some mysterious anti-gravity pressure that permeates the vacuum of space. So in the end, Einstein's biggest blunder was saying that lambda was his biggest blunder.
See, and that's very good, though. In terms of the question of the scientific process, it's really important for people to understand how this stuff develops. And it's
It's not just burst out of a hatch.
Right, exactly.
Right. This stuff, people struggle, toil, sweat, generally no blood, but sweat.
I'm a little worried about that.
of the blood, sweat, and tears, of the big three, is certainly sweat and tears.
Mm-hmm. Which brings me to this. And this was something that was kind of like, whoa, wait a minute. Neil is saying this. You got to think about this. You said that your greatest nightmare is the impact of accelerating universe.
Oh, yeah. I have several nightmares. But yeah, that one's up there. Oh, you want me to go public on this nightmare? Okay.
Yes, definitely.
Okay, so this accelerating universe. So we knew the universe was expanding. In 1998, we learned it's not only expanding, it's accelerating. And this is the property of this mysterious anti-gravity pressure in the vacuum that's making this happen. Now, if this keeps up, since the negative gravity pressure lives in the vacuum and is a property of the vacuum, the bigger is the vacuum, the stronger is this accelerative pressure relative to gravity itself. And so the acceleration accelerates, if you will. You have an exponential growth in the size of the universe, stretching the fabric of space and time on a scale so significant that even galaxies that we otherwise would think of as nearby are stretched beyond our visible horizon. Their location in space is stretched away from us. So there will come a day where there are no galaxies in the night sky because they went beyond our horizon, which renders them invisible and undetectable. So my nightmare is that if you're a cosmologist of that future and you're trying to figure out the history of the universe, there has been a chapter removed from it. Your book is missing pages, and you don't even know it. Unless somehow you have access to records that we're taking now to tell you about these galaxies, because as you look farther out in space, you look farther back in time. We can see evidence of the Big Bang. That's why we have cosmology at all. Where there's no distant galaxies, there's no access to the depths of time, and therefore there's no data, and therefore there's no hypothesis, and you've got no understanding. Or you can come up with an understanding, but it'll be incomplete. So, that's the preamble to say my biggest nightmare is wondering whether what we are doing to try to decode our universe is missing a chapter that we don't even know should be there. A chapter that manifested sometime in the distant past, but now there's no trace of it. Because if that's the case, we will never get the right answer for how the universe works in its entirety.
Wow. We have time for, I think, maybe one question, one and a half questions more. And I wanted to ask you this about the situation facing science in this country today. And I was thinking about in particular, I've interviewed Michael Mann a number of times on my show, and I watched as he went into Congress and sat there with like sort of Mo, Larry, and Curly. And they were where they talked about, you know, and they had somebody brought a snowball in at another thing in Congress and said, this proves that there's no, you know, no global warming, all this kind of stuff. There's an actually seems to be a very bad situation developing in this country in relation to science, around the climate, around many other things as well. I wanted you to speak to that and the importance of, or what you thought of the March for Science in relation to that.
Yeah, I think what it comes down to is that people, even people we and they themselves would judge to be educated. Essentially, everyone in Congress went to college. Some even went to graduate school, or at least law school or business school. Some. So we'd like to call them educated people. But if you call yourself educated, yet do not know what science is, nor how and why it works, then that's a gap in your educational trajectory. And that gap is not filled in any school system curriculum that I've yet laid eyes upon. So somewhere in there, you have to think that students are not empty vessels into which you are pouring the knowledge and facts of science, but that you are an entity that is empowered to process information, to analyze information, to know how science works, to know how it doesn't work, so that you don't confuse the two. If we had that kind of background, you would not have senators or members of Congress throwing snowballs on the floor. You would not have such rampant science denial, because people would understand what science is and what its strengths as well as limitations are. So, yeah, it's for me, it's a little late that adults already feel this way. You want to make sure that you raise a generation who does not have that susceptibility. But I can tell you this, if the adults don't get on the bandwagon immediately, then we run the risk of legislation being passed that has no anchor in an objective reality. Mm-hmm. And as I've said many times, that would then be the beginning of the end of an informed democracy.
Mm-hmm. One more question, and that is, there's something at the very end of the book that you just go on for a little while with, and I thought it was very powerful, and it would be important for people to at least get a sense of what you're talking about there, the cosmic perspective.
Yeah, so astrophysicists, not uniquely, but certainly with great enthusiasm, we are sort of keepers of the cosmic perspective, and we know what it is, we know its impact, and this is a worldview established by looking at Earth from above, specifically Earth from space. And you realize how small we are, how fragile we are, how land masses, when you view Earth from space, do not display color-coded boundaries for countries. So it's an illuminating, enlightening point of view that actually will dismantle your ego if you came in with an ego too high. But it could rebuild your ego once you learn that the molecules in your body, the atoms in the molecules, are traceable to stars that have given their lives and have exploded and enriched gas clouds that made subsequent generations of stars. And some of those planets in orbit around those stars, you have people. So it's not that we're made of special ingredients and therefore we're special. It's that we're made of the same ingredients as stars. And it's the fact that we're the same that makes us special. The fact that we all have DNA in common that makes us special, not whatever you can muster to distinguish yourself from everyone else. And I would lay the bet that most wars, most armed conflict in the history of the world came about because of a difference in opinion as to whose politics, religion, culture, or just attitude was more true or more important or more significant. So, yes, I wax on. The entire last chapter, the 12th and final chapter, is all about the cosmic perspective. I hope it wasn't too long, because I couldn't. There's a lot I had to get off my chest, and it's all in there.
No, it was really important that it was there. I thought I was really moved by it. I really learned a lot off of it. Mm-hmm. All right, Neil deGrasse Tyson, and thank you for being on the show. And the book is Astrophysics for People in a Hurry. And, Neil, thank you very much again for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Once again, that was Neil deGrasse Tyson, and we were talking about his new book. And I'm telling you, folks, very important to keep up with what people like Neil are doing. All right? It's very important to support them when it's needed and to learn the kind of method that they're approaching the world with. All right? Well, that just about brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board op for today, Kiana Williams, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. And if anyone out there who's listening to this and is really moved to get involved with all this, please do write us, because you can be living 1,000 miles away, 3,000 miles away, and we can still work with each other on all kinds of aspects to get this show out in the biggest possible way, because that's what we need to do in the world that we're facing today. All right? And I'm looking forward to talking with you again next week. We're going to go out now with Decision from Outer National. Talk to you again next week. We'll be right back.